Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. My name is Lauren Litton. I am the host of Spotlight on Youth, a radio show dedicated to social and legal trends impacting the rights and well-being of children across the country. Spotlight on Youth is a project of the Children's Law Center, Inc., a not-for-profit children's rights legal services organization. The show is being streamed live over the Internet and will be available on demand after its conclusion. We encourage you to participate by asking our guest questions live on air by dialing 347-994-1149. That's 347-994-1149. And to indicate you have a question, you're going to press the number 1 on your telephone keypad, and you'll be placed in a queue where Jillian will screen you in. Also, feel free to log in our chat room and pose a question there. On this show, we frequently talk about better outcomes for youth who are at risk or already involved in the juvenile justice system and highlight research and various strategies that can assist in that goal. Two critical juncture points that are repeatedly mentioned are schools and detention settings. It makes sense that keeping kids in school and out of correctional settings helps contribute to their development into healthy and productive citizens. However, policies and procedures don't always support that approach, leading to enormous school dropout rates, overrepresentation of youth of color in the juvenile justice system, and a decrease in public safety, often tethered to an increase in cost to the public. Our guests today are here to share how they're working to transform their local systems with collaboration and judicial leadership as key elements. Our guests today are Steve Teske, who is the Chief Judge of the Juvenile Court of Clayton County, Georgia. He has been appointed by past and current governors to serve on numerous boards and commissions, including the Georgia Council on the Criminal Justice Reform, the Board of the Georgia Children and Youth Coordinating Council, the Governor's Office for Children and Families, and the Judicial Advisory to the Board of the Development of Juvenile Justice. Judge Teske has also served as a representative for Georgia on the Federal Advisory Committee on Juvenile Justice. He is a member of many local, state, and national organizations, a national speaker and trainer, and is widely published on issues related to judicial leadership, breaking the school-to-prison pipeline, and reducing reliance on detention and incarceration. Rob Wiederstein is the Chief District Judge for Henderson County, Kentucky. He was first elected to the District Court in 1998 after serving 3 years as an assistant county attorney. Judge Wiederstein also saw a need to address the disparities in health and education for youth in his community, as well as their over-incarceration, and has helped establish collaboratives and attract resources to address these problems. He has published several articles and presents on issues related to juvenile justice reform. He, his wife Kathy, and their two children live in Henderson, and his hobbies include the banjo and triathlons. Also joining us is Steve Gold, who is the county attorney for Henderson County. He is responsible for the prosecution of crimes, collection of bad checks, past due taxes, and child support, and he serves as the legal advisor to the county's governing body. He has focused on obtaining better outcomes from the juvenile justice system and created a juvenile victim offender conferencing program in his office. He believes that a prosecutor who is tough on crime is not always the same as a prosecutor who gets that you must be smart on crime when it comes to youth. Steve also represents the Kentucky County Attorneys Association on the Kentucky Legislators Juvenile Code Revision Task Force and on the Kentucky Child Support Guidelines Review Commission. So I'd like to welcome the three of you to the show.
Good to be with you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I really want to start off by hearing from each of you what led you to sort of become champions for juvenile justice reform and what surprised you from your respective perspectives as judges and a prosecutor. So Judge Teske, why don't we start with you?
Thanks, Lauren. My experience began when I first took the bench. Actually, my first day on the bench back in 1999, and I experienced, in what I thought an inordinate number of cases, but I think worse than that were the type or nature of the cases, before me. back in 1999, our detention hearings had to be held every single day as opposed to today. They're only on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. But even back then, on every day, we could have a docket as high as 24 kids who'd been detained, of which many of those were kids arrested on school campus, and many of them for misdemeanor or low-risk cases. And it really bothered me. And so, you know, taking that anecdotally, you know, after a while, and I, you know, wanted to get my feet wet a little bit, then I began to request, you know, more concrete information through our IT people. And the results came back, you know, confirming, you know, what I was experiencing anecdotally. And that, you know, just to sum it up, by the year 2004, we had, you know, experienced, you know, since 1995 or 96, a 2,000% increase in school-related offenses. And then finally, attending all of that, you know, our graduation rates were going down, and by 03 had plummeted to an all-time low of 58%. And at the same time, our juvenile crime rate was seriously increasing. And so the pivotal point for us in turning all this around was in 2004. Although we did begin some reform measures in 2001, but it really started to, you know, take foot in 2004. So, you know, it just bothered me, to sum it up, that I was seeing so many kids on low-level misdemeanor offenses being handcuffed, put in jail overnight, and brought down to the court. And it had bothered me. I just knew that intuitively it was wrong. And then, of course, you know, as I did the research, got involved in some of the things I'll share later, you know, that it no doubt was wrong what we were doing back in 1999.
Rob, was your experience similar, or
no? It wasn't similar. I grew up in the prosecutor's office. You know, I did 3 or 4 years in the prosecutor's office, and then in Kentucky we had Heath High School, the Heath High School shooting in Paducah, Kentucky, and so there was kind of this almost custom, I don't know how to, you know, that if a child had a problem at the school and, you know, public safety was in any way implicated, we locked them up. And so we kind of, that's what we did. And if you had a problem, that's how you responded. So I come to you know, I get on the bench about 1999. Juvenile court's that thing you do on Monday mornings. And it's not something I frankly enjoyed all that much. You know, it's kind of that thing you did, and you had a lot of kids, and they, you know, we were doing quite a few detention hearings. Remember, we're probably a lot smaller than Judge Teske's community. We're a community of about 44,000. But for, I don't know, to about 2009, for about 9 years, you know, I was a cog in this big machine, and I thought my job was to put kids in jail. Now, I don't take any innate pleasure in that, but, and frankly, I really don't like it, but I thought, well, you know, I'm a judge now, and that's what I'm supposed to do. And, you know, you go to conferences, and the, you know, the response from other judges was, you know, well, you're doing just what everybody else is doing. So I didn't ever have that sense of, you know, that maybe there's a different way to do this. It never really occurred to me. And we were getting these complaints from the school system that, you know, things just weren't going well, and that we were going to, you know, that perhaps more judicial supervision, let's say, of these children was the answer. And in about 2009, Steve Gold and I had a pretty interesting conversation, and I think maybe that'd be a nice segue to Steve Gold.
Well, that conversation came up. The judge was hearing from the school system, hey, you ought to be doing more to these kids. You know, why aren't you really putting the hammer down? And I was hearing the same thing. And so we had both been doing a little bit of research. And about that time, the Kentucky Kids Count data book came out, and it showed that Henderson County was, on a per capita basis, having more complaints to court for juveniles than any other county in the state by far. The second and third out of 120 counties were very far behind us. So when we start having this conversation about, you know, people want more done, the response was, well, actually, Henderson is doing more than any other county. We're leading the state in cases going to court. And that led us on a several-year journey now into discovering what would maybe be a little more effective than just sending a kid to court, because what we found is that, in general, we weren't helping, especially with the low-risk, low-level offenders. And one thing that has been something that each of us have really pushed has been trying to push valid assessments as early in the process as possible. And that's not something that Kentucky was particularly good at, still isn't. Hopefully it's getting there, but with that early assessment of risk and needs, we feel like we can do better than just sending every kid to court and going through a long process that generally research shows just isn't all that helpful.
And you're starting to already talk about, you know, how you started to address the problems, but I want to just step back a little bit and talk about what contributed to the high numbers of low-level misdemeanor kids you saw in the courtrooms. Judge Tessie, you talked about them, you know, being shackled and also the high dropout rate. So if you can talk about maybe some of the policies and procedure that lead to that problem.
Well, this is Steve Teske. You know, when you know, I was going through this period and was concerned about the type of cases coming into court, you know, I did research and take a look at what was what we call the drivers, what's driving these cases in the court. Now, for us at the time, the major feeder or driver was our school system. And, you know, and I want to be careful here not to, you know, get into blaming behavior because, you know, it's real quick to you know, for us to say, well, because police are on campus, you know, that's going to obviously drive it up. And then administrators, you know, can be creative and therefore they're going to, you know, push some of these kids, you know, over to the police and use them as a disciplinary tool. There's no doubt, okay, that those dynamics do happen, okay? But I think what we would be remiss if we didn't try to explain why those dynamics happen. And let me, I'll just sum it up this way. It's a systemic issue. Police are, you know, were put into our schools in Clayton County. They were not specially trained around adolescent development and so forth and so on. And they did exactly what they were trained to do, probable cause, make an arrest, you know, bring the kid on down. You know, schools, on the other hand, you know, they have resource issues and they operate within a vacuum for the most part. They have their own rules, budgets, you know, different source of revenue, and they have a difficult population, you know, or different dynamics because, you know, they may have, you know, we have high schools here with many as 1,000 to 1,200 kids under a roof. And so, you know, I just want to be careful about that. Was one. The other one was just the old traditional system that I call fortress or bunker supervision, probation supervision. The thing was that, hey, if a kid commits a delinquent act, you know, then we're going to respond, we're going to punish the kid, put the kid on probation without any question about assessment. I mean, what Rob and Steve Gold are talking about is very, very important about, you know, looking at ways to do assessments up front. And you know, I like to sum it up this way, you know, which kids scare me versus which kids make me mad. We were doing a very poor job of that. So even kids out in the neighborhoods and elsewhere, as they were funneled in, you know, we were doing a very poor job of assessing them and separating the scary ones from the ones who make us mad and creating opportunities for those kids who make us mad to be treated, you know, without going deeper into the system. So we were pushing them deeper into the system. So it was the old traditional approach, and we had to find ways to deal with that.
Rob or Steve, do you have anything you want to add about things that you saw contributing to the problems of low graduation rates, overrepresentation?
Lauren, can we go back? Can we go back
sure.
to this this idea of schools?
Mm-hmm.
Because what happened in Henderson was very interesting. In that, the way we started this was sitting down with the school and the police chief. You know, once it was brought to our attention, and I was embarrassed by it. Okay, I had no idea that we were, you know, this high, and I didn't know about it. And I kind of found out about it on happenstance, and so, you know, Steve Gold and I had a strong feeling that that it meant something. While we didn't know what it meant, it wasn't something that we thought was good, and so we sat down with them. And we had a really candid conversation about what's going on in schools. And school people are under a tremendous amount of pressure. So I certainly, our goal has been to get better, to have accountability, because the kids need that, but not to do it in a way that causes them any long-term, you know, damage. While the original conversations were pretty awkward and difficult, you can only when you say to somebody, do you realize that when you approach kids with a punitive and stigmatizing consequence, that you're likely to get even worse behavior? The people that really get that are school people. Now, not all of them, not uniformly. So if you're going to have any sort of success at reform, you've really got to partner with schools. And I just wanted to go back and emphasize that, because in the long run, it's been the schools that have really championed the initiative. They've been critical.
And this is
this is Steve Teske. I just wanted to say one quick thing in support of this comment, and that is that the school system is the foundation in developing what I call a community care plan. He is absolutely right. You know, we have to get around the schools and support the schools and helping them, okay, in every way we can in the community, in supporting them in asset building of these kids. Because otherwise, we don't. They are all by themselves. They are isolated. And as a result, it's a matter of default. They will result in responding in a punitive way. That's why out-of-school suspensions are so high in many school systems, because it becomes a default. But you can slow it down if we change our perspective as a community and say we need to have a community care plan for the entire community to increase the quality of life, beginning with our children, and that means we need to do it around the school system.
Okay. Steve, Steve Gold, I think you were going to add something as well.
Yes, I was going to echo what each of the judges were saying in that the school was definitely a driver here, what we were seeing, but they were doing exactly what our state law expected them to do. As Judge Wiederstein mentioned, Kentucky had a legacy for several years of having a very traumatic experience, and with a school shooting, and a lot of zero tolerance policies were implemented, and schools were told, this is how you should handle this. Get these into court. And so, I don't think they're necessarily to blame, other than, as Judge Teske said, it was a systemic issue that everybody was doing exactly what they were supposed to be doing in the system. The problem is the system was not designed to get the outcomes that anyone desired. And that's a tough sell, going to people and saying, hey, I know you're doing exactly what you're supposed to do, but let's do something else because it's not working.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, Rob, you had mentioned, how do we basically balance accountability without long-term damage? So that's, to me, a great question to ask the three of you. What have you been doing to sort of shift the response? All three of you have said that basically the system was responding the way it was designed to, but it wasn't designed the way for the long-term outcomes that we, the three of us, and almost anyone working in the system hope for, and the community hopes for our kids. So why don't we start talking about what legislatively that you've been looking at, and also on the ground, the policies and practices. Who would like to start?
Can I share with you a couple stories, maybe?
Sure.
5 years ago in our courtroom, the arguments we were having were, how much time should we give this child, and how many community service hours should he or she get? And so what that really is a debate about is you know, we know that detention is not effective. And then in Henderson, what we were doing is on Saturday mornings, we would order these kids to perform this community service, and they would go out in this van together. We would collect other antisocial kids together, and we'd put them in a van, and we'd send them out to do the stigmatizing work of picking up garbage. And so the argument was, are we going to make them do that for 10 or 20 hours? That was the sophistication at that time. And so, you know, when we talk about, you know, what do you not do? What are the things that you shouldn't be doing? Detention is certainly, you know, unless the child's really dangerous. But the other thing is collecting kids together who have similar personality attributes like that. And so our sophistication has improved. You know, we don't have those arguments anymore. So I hope that kind of responds. You know, going back to this idea of risk, you know, target your resources towards kids who are dangerous. And if they're not, then, you know, put them back into the community. And I think that goes by the idea of the risk principle.
No, this is Steve Teske. I absolutely agree. And what we did, which is which led to what you're describing in terms of approach, and it is an evidence-based approach. But what I was frustrated. I'm seeking help, and I turned to and I did some research, and actually I happened to be in Portland, Oregon, at the American Probation Parole Association way back in 2000. So I've been on the bench for a little less than a year, and matter of fact, only for several months. And, you know, I go up there to Portland, and I saw this workshop, this Annie E. Casey Foundation Juvenile Detention Alternative Initiative. Went to the workshop. The folks in Portland were putting on there a model site, one of the original sites for JDAI. And then they took me on a visit. Anyway, I came back and I just did some more research, and I pursued the Annie Casey Foundation's JDAI in their ACOR strategies, which were around collaboration, judicial leadership, objective risk, admission instruments and data, collecting data, analyzing data, reducing racial and ethnic disparity. They had, this approach, this model. I thought it made a lot of sense. And so that's when on my own I pursue, beginning with, a detention assessment instrument, to reduce the number of kids being detained, especially those kids of color. And then, it springboard from there. And it was through that process that inspired me here in Clayton County to take a look at what I deemed to be low-hanging fruit in reducing detention, and that was the school referrals. How can we slow this down? And the rest of the story is bringing the stakeholders together to develop a protocol to do that, eventually led to an 83% reduction in school arrest. Among many other things I can talk about through this show, but I'll just stop right there.
Lauren, how far away from your original question have we gone?
all of you are fine. I was just seeing, Steve Gold, if you wanted to add something at this point. We do have a question from a listener, and Steve, maybe you'll start off the response.
Sure.
But Rob, you had talked about that you sort of were shocked when you discovered what you discovered, and maybe even embarrassed by it. So the question is, what kind of tips or recommendations would you give to communities, to prosecutors and judges about trying to figure out what really is going on?
Well, if you've got really high juvenile crime rates, you've got some big problems. And not everybody understands it. And we certainly, I certainly didn't, I didn't realize we were having a juvenile crime problem at first. So what you should be doing is going and looking for what's called a phenomena called clustering. And crime, to some degree, is a failure of kids to have impulse control. Okay? If they see it, they do it. And so any jurisdiction that's having high rates of crime is often going to have high rates of teen pregnancy. It's going to have rates of high drug and alcohol addiction issues. You're going to be struggling to get kids to graduate from your local high school. And so one of the things that you do is get your community to understand that this is a bigger problem than just juvenile crime, and that it will ultimately impact the quality of your future labor force. Okay, I know that's a little broad,
mm-hmm.
but having high rates of juvenile crime is a big issue. And so if you can frame it in that way for your, whether it's your elected officials, your economic development people, your schools, it is creating some incentive from in the community, you've got to address these issues. Ignoring them is not going to help anybody. It's not going to help kids. It's certainly in the long run not going to help your community. So I don't know how much impact we've had, but we're trying to have that conversation.
This is Steve Gold, and I want to echo what was said there. As far as steps for a community to go through, I would say that first thing is to gather data. You've really got to know where you are before you can figure out where you want to go. And that was something that, we didn't just take a snapshot of the number of kids going to court. Like Judge Wiederstein said, we looked at everything. We looked at all outcomes that youth were receiving in our county. We looked at dropout rates. We looked at teen pregnancy. You name it. We took all of those and tried to paint a bigger picture. And that led us into that second step. Once we had all that data, including school discipline data that they keep internally. That's when we started building the coalitions. And that collaboration was incredibly important. And having the school willing to sit down and really look at things was very important. And that, being able to build that team, and I will say the power to convene is something that is very important that judges have. If it's just a prosecutor that calls up and says, I want to talk about juvenile justice, people have a certain expectation. But when it is a judge that says, hey, everybody, we need to meet about this, it did have a lot of credibility, and we had a whole lot of people show up to these meetings, from all the stakeholders, and when we presented this data, it presented a clear enough picture to know that something had to be done here. And so I think that would, you know, the first step is get the data. Second step is to start to build a coalition and start the discussion, and then go forward.
And Judge Tessie, maybe before you respond, I'd like to shift this a little bit, just even based on Steve, what you just talked about, how a judge is positioned to actually convene. You know, there's a lot of people who will sit back and be like, this is not the judge's role, or why would a prosecutor even think about this? So I want to hear your responses about judicial leadership and engagement, and then also from a prosecutor's perspective about what is your role, why should you be involved in reforms like this and paying attention for kids?
Well, sure. Let me just, you know, in case there's any judges in the audience or, you know, that let me look at it or, respond from the perspective of a judge who is thinking just that, because I have come across those judges in my travels who have raised the question, you know, well, I don't think that's my role. But they'll even go further and say, I think I'm violating my judicial canons of ethics by stepping off the bench and exerting that type of activism. Here's my response. And judges, you'll understand this. We go to our judicial canons of ethics. First of all, number one, you know, take a look at your judicial canons. Here in Georgia, I believe it's judicial canon number 4. And your state will have the same canon, because I think all the states have adopted the same thing from the American Bar Association model judicial canons of ethics that says that judges may, okay, lecture, speak, write, they may sit on boards, they may engage the legislature, testify before legislative bodies, they may engage the executive branch in matters that will improve the administration of justice. The administration of justice. Now, I don't know about you, but you know what? If I can help develop a system by bringing stakeholders together that is going to stop the flow of unnecessary cases coming to juvenile court, that I know by feeding this court, I'm going to make those kids worse, and by making those kids worse, I'm going to make the community worse. That is no doubt promoting the administration, you know, of this court. And lastly, you know, I need to tell you this, that for Georgia, we certainly didn't seem to have a problem with, because we have a statute, we've had it for a number of years, that authorizes juvenile court judges to engage stakeholders and to bring them together for the purpose of negotiating written protocols to address issues of delinquency and dependency and chins, and also to prevent those things from occurring. You know, here's the thing. The real role here is about how do you translate your due process role on the bench to your role off the bench that will enhance your due process role on the bench. I think it's one affects the other and vice versa. They complement one another. It's a matter of how you do it. And for some judges, I agree, you know, Steve Gold made a very good point. You know, you don't have to get out there necessarily. If you feel uncomfortable taking this solid position and advocating, okay, fine. I don't feel that way. but I can appreciate you being that way, and that's okay. But there's nothing in the rules that say you can't do what Steve Gold was describing and what Rob has done as a judge, and that is simply, will you all please come together? Will you please meet with me so we can discuss these issues? Now, where in the world does that violate some judicial canon of ethic or a law? It doesn't.
Okay. Rob or Steve, want to add anything?
I remember when we were kind of getting started, there was a What Works conference in Wren Lake, Illinois. Now, those of you that don't know where Henderson, Kentucky is, we're pretty rural, and we're Western Kentucky, and so, you know, I guess most of the country would say, well, we're pretty poor, too. And there was a What Works conference in Wren Lake, Illinois, in southern Illinois, and it's a really poor part of the country, too. And we drive all the way out into the middle of nowhere. And here they are having what's called a What Works conference for juvenile justice. And I'm there at this conference, and Judge George Timberlake, who's from Southern Illinois, is standing up at the podium explaining how, you know, you don't always want to put these kids in jail, that sometimes that may be the worst decision you could possibly make. And he gets done speaking, and another prosecutor from Northern Illinois gets up there and talks about, you know, you really need to be careful about detaining kids, and, you know, you need to be given assessments, you need to be doing this. And I came back to Henderson, Kentucky, and I said to my friend Steve Gold here, I said, Steve, you're not going to believe this. They actually stand up in public in Southern Illinois and say this stuff from a podium. Can you believe this? Because in Kentucky, that has not been the culture. Now, remember, Illinois, I think, is a model state. You know, but at least in Kentucky, that message hadn't gotten over our direction yet. And so, you know, there are lots of judges and prosecutors talking about the nuances of this decision. They're out there. And in some states, you may have to look for them a little bit, but they're out there.
Well, one of the things, you know, we hear around the country, even from prosecutors and judges that believe in this, that they're afraid to say anything because they're elected officials and what the public is going to view them. And from a collaborative approach, sometimes I hear that, you know, we can't get the prosecutors especially to the table, or how do we collaborate with them? Steve, what tips or suggestions do you have to either prosecutors listening out there or those communities that are looking to bring their prosecutors into collaboratives like this?
Lauren, we've had that phenomenon here as well. I have been to Kentucky County Attorneys Association meetings and, you know, preached some of this and had in general a very warm reception, but there's always a couple of folks out there that look at me like, is he really saying this? We may believe what he's saying, but he might have actually lost his marbles. He can't say this in public. But the reality is we are elected not just to prosecute the crime in front of us. I truly believe that as a prosecutor, we are elected to do what we can about future crime. And with adults, a lot of times, that means creating paths to redemption for individuals, helping them get into a GED program or something like that. But with juveniles, I think it is incumbent upon us to find a way not just to punish the smashing the mailbox or whatever that delinquent act may have been, but to find a way to make sure that we don't see that kid in the future, create that path to success for them. And I've not had a single constituent come up to me angry about whatever happened on some particular case, that when I sat down with them and talked to them about it, they've never faulted anything that we've done or that concept. It's a difficult thing, and sometimes it takes time to explain it. We've done a whole lot of public education here locally. We've gone to every civic club you can imagine. We've had a good partnership with the local newspaper, and I think when you go out and you let people know, hey, what we're doing isn't working, we're glad to continue to keep doing it, but it's not helping. So we're going to do something that is going to work. People get that, and I think people like the concept of being smart on crime, of being proactive and being helpful. The concept that there are no throwaway kids. And when you can really get a community behind that, you'll never get 100%, but when you can get enough momentum in your community behind that, you're really going to get something done. And I think that's really what a prosecutor should be doing. And if I do honestly think that most good prosecutors are doing that. There is a perception from a lot of stakeholders, oh, well, prosecutors want this and want that. But I think if you actually sit down with your prosecutor, juvenile court prosecutors, by and large, just about everyone I've ever met, they're not doing it because they have to. They choose to be in juvenile court because they have a passion for helping young people. And they get this. Mm-hmm. The ones that spend their days in the trenches in juvenile court generally know that this is a better approach. So I would strongly encourage anybody out there looking to form a coalition and to collaborate to go to your, not just the elected official, but also their assistants that are working in juvenile court and have those discussions with them. I think you would be very surprised what you're going to run into.
Okay. I'd like to remind our listeners, if they want to ask a question live on air of any of our guests, to call 347-994-1149, and you're going to press the number 1 on your telephone keypad. I know when we started talking about changes and what you were doing, heard a little bit about JDAI and risk assessments, but both in Georgia and Kentucky, you're looking at changing legislatively sort of the infrastructure so that there is, you know, a state support that builds in this work. So I didn't know if you could share what's happening in your respective states for our listeners. I think that'd be really interesting.
Well, yeah,
Judge
you know,
Teske,
I can go.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is Steve Teske. So last year, the governor, you know, I had the pleasure of serving at the pleasure of the governor on our Criminal Justice Reform Commission. The previous year, he had created that for looking at adult reform, and there were sweeping reforms there, but then focused on juvenile justice. And we pretty much, some would say, threw out the delinquency code and created an entirely new one. Here's the bottom line in a nutshell, and that is reducing commitments to the state by requiring, number one, that there's a threshold, a minimum threshold. For Georgia, you cannot commit a misdemeanor offense unless there's three separate prior adjudications, of which at least one has to be a felony. Number two, you can no longer commit violation of probations to the state. And you now have to, the judge has to review a risk and needs assessment if that judge is considering committing the child to the state. And if the judge commits contrary to the findings of the risk and needs assessment, the judge must justify that in the order. Now, the focus in that, number one, the reason for that is what we've been talking about so far, all three of us, and that is separating the scary kids from the kids who make us mad, and not taking the kids who make us mad, mixing them with the kids who scare us, and therefore aggravating the circumstances and making them worse. The problem is, in most states, I think, and it certainly was in Georgia, is that we were just driving so many kids into institutions and residential bed space that we were just throwing money at it, and it wasn't fixing the problem. We were not smart. And so now we need to get smart, and we have to make the tough decision. That is, cut the bed space, turn around and redirect those monies to the local level. Now, you know, let me just end with this. You know, there was a reason Governor Deal put me on the commission, okay? You know, I had introduced these same type of formulas and approaches early in the last decade. And one thing I think needs to be mentioned that, you know, supports what we've been talking about and how do we help communities, you know, wrap their head around the fact that just because something looks soft doesn't mean that it's not tough. It's a matter of redefining what it means to hold a kid accountable and being tough with the kid. And so for us in Clayton County, since we've introduced these reforms, when they really took foot in 2004, since 2004, our juvenile crime is down 60%. Our residential burglaries alone, that, you know, 60% less kids are committing residential burglaries. Our graduation rates have increased 24%. You know, even in our diversion programs, our recent three-year study of recidivist rates, I mean, you know, kids who have reoffended, you know, we only have a 10% over the last 3 years of kids going through diversion, which supports this. We need to be very careful assuming that just because a kid does a delinquent act that they have to be treated in a harsh way, that many of these kids are already hardwired, are already wired to do stupid things. We need to let some of these kids be kids, and they will age out, okay? And we will make them worse and drive them into the delinquency system, and we will compromise our community safety if we are not smart.
So what's happening in Kentucky?
Gold is our expert on that.
Well, we did have our legislature put together a task force to review our juvenile code and brought in this really smart judge from Clayton County, Georgia, to come talk to us. that was really helpful. And out of 2 years of meetings, last month came out with our final report, and there is a legislative package that is being sent to our session that has just gone in within the next few days. And a lot of what Judge Teske is talking about is going to be reflected in that. Kentucky is looking at doing some things very similar to what Georgia has done and cherry-picking some things from a few other states as well. The big thing that we're going to be doing is doing that early risk and needs assessment. As he said, separating the scary kids from the ones that make us mad, and finding out what sort of interventions are going to be appropriate. There's going to be some requirement for graduated sanctions, both in the school before it makes it to court and through the court before we get to the point of a commitment. So that is something that most good schools and most good prosecutors and judges we're doing in Kentucky, but it wasn't uniform, and so that's going to be codified in statute. And there are some tweaks that are going to be made to the length of times, or length of time that a juvenile can spend in out-of-home placement, and that's going to be related to not just the seriousness of the offense, but also to the risk and need level. And that, I think, is somewhat of a sea change for thinking in Kentucky and a very positive move. The other thing that we're going to do, and this, anytime you bring this out, sometimes hijacks any discussion on juvenile justice, but we are going to be completely rethinking the way we treat status offenders. And to a large extent, they will not be coming to court in Kentucky anymore if this bill passes. That's the conception that will occur. There would be a very rare situation for one to actually end up in court. And then there's an incentive program that we're hoping that the legislature will fund for local agencies, collaborative groups, judicially led with prosecutors and several other folks and stakeholders involved. There will be fiscal incentives from some of the savings that will be realized from not incarcerating status offenders to create some grants for local programming for intervention. And that's a problem in Kentucky. We have 120 counties. We have the second highest number of counties in the United States, I think. Only Texas has more. And many of them have no resources, particularly mental health resources for juveniles. And that becomes a problem. And Judge Wiederstein always uses the saying, when the only thing that you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And when the only thing you have is commitment and detention, that tends to be what happens around the state. So I really think these fiscal incentives to allow localities to come up with their own solutions and interventions, that can be a major force for change in Kentucky,
mm-hmm.
assuming they get funded, which hopefully the legislature will do that.
Well, we have about 10 minutes left. And I know each of you could probably go on for a few more hours, but maybe as you kind of wrap up into to final words, something, each one, maybe a story you want to share about a success and your hopes for future reforms. If we were going to have this conversation in a few years, you know, what do you, would you like to see happen? Rob, do you want to start?
You have stunned us into silence.
I know. Wow.
That's hard to do with three
well,
lawyers.
You know, it, you know, I could take it from the angle over the last 4 or 5 years, just as Steve was very flattering, and I appreciated your comment, and I enjoyed going up and speaking before his task force. I really enjoy Kentucky. I've been up there several times, and really, really great people. I admire Rob and Steve for their leadership because, you know, it really takes that type of leadership to bring these discussions to the table before you can forge, something new. And so they're very innovative in that sense. And I say that, I want to start there because just to give you some quick examples, I got an email 2 days ago from Spring Branch Independent School District in Harris County, Houston. I was there just a few months ago, and the United Way and the religious community and some others brought me in there. They brought together 170 stakeholders, various school districts, law enforcement. Essentially, I spent the entire day there working with them about reducing school referrals. The email I received 2 days ago is great news on how they had, adopted these approaches. And already in just a few months, they have experienced a 53% reduction, in suspensions, in arrest, and that other good things are happening. Wichita, Kansas, I came across a school board member there earlier this year at a Coalition for Juvenile Justice, and she just came up to me and she said, "Yeah, I just want to let you know miracles are happening." Her words were, "Miracles are happening." In Wichita, Kansas, that in just reducing the school referrals, other things are taking place that are just so positive. Okay, Connecticut, you want to talk about school shootings? So unfortunately, one that happened, this past week. Well, we all know what happened in Connecticut, and I was there in 2010, made two visits, brought up a team up there. We worked with several jurisdictions. And about four jurisdictions up there have reduced their school arrests by as much as 95%. But yet this school shooting happened. They are remaining strong because of the positive outcomes that are happening in terms of graduation rates and other great things that are going on. Broward County just recently, Fort Lauderdale, signed their agreement. I was down there a year ago to assist Judge Elijah Williams there. Gainesville, Florida, the National Council of Juvenile Family Court Judges have just identified 16 sites across the country, and we are sending consultants there. There's just so many great stories that are going on in juvenile justice, Kentucky being, you know, the most recent in what they're doing, the recommendations they made to the legislature. And by the way, if you want to look at those recommendations, it's an excellent report. I had a chance to read it last night on the plane coming back home. You can go to the Pew Charitable Trust website, and you can download that report.
Thank you. Robert.
Lauren, I guess in summary what I would say to you is it's about relationships and it's about caring. And when we forget that, we're going to have a lot of problems. And that's I guess, how I'd like to end it today.
Amen.
Gold, I was trying to get you to – I know we only got a minute or two. I was hoping you'd maybe mention your restorative justice.
Well, that's exactly where I was going to go. I would say to anyone, especially prosecutors, considering looking at juvenile justice or doing something about it, even if you can't make a systemic change right off the bat, I would strongly advise them to look into victim-offender conferencing, restorative justice. It goes by several different names, but essentially it's peacemaking, getting victims and offenders to sit down in a safe setting and discuss things. We have had so many successes from that it's really moving the needle on court referrals here locally. And we've got a 5.5% recidivism rate on that, and that's been a very successful program for us. And the great thing about it is that it empowers victims, something that prosecutors always love to do, and usually ends in tears and hugs on all sides and a lot more understanding. It's a process that humanizes both sides. You know, we as adults a lot of times will look at these kids that make us mad and shake our fist and say, why these kids today? And then the juvenile, when they have smashed that mailbox or broken the window or whatever, they feel like they've offended a mailbox or a window. And this process helps the adult get to know that it was a real person, this juvenile, that did this, and gives them an opportunity to speak to them. And from the juvenile standpoint, they realize that they have wronged a person, not just a thing. And that has been very powerful. And I think if prosecutors around the state and around the nation look at implementing programs like that, they'll really get on board with this, because what happens is the first few times you see it work, you feel like you've done something magical, even though it's an ancient process that is very, very effective. And I think that is the first step to getting prosecutors really on board.
Thank you. So for our listeners, some of the resources that have been mentioned on today's show, the Juvenile Detention Alternatives Initiative, you can find out more about that at jdaihelpdesk.org. The National Council of Juvenile Family Court Judges is ncjfcj.org. Pew Charitable Trust is the pewenvironment.org. And our last episode on Spotlight on Youth focused solely on restorative justice and the process that Steve was just talking about. So we encourage you to listen in on that show, and there's a lot of resources mentioned. Judge Teske, Judge Wieders, and Steve Gold, thank you so much for being on the show and sharing your stories. And I think you've really encouraged, I'm sure we're going to get requests for your information, but one of the things that you've also said is for people not to be afraid to reach out to your peers to learn what's happening and to get advice and to even bring people into your community. So thank you all for being here.
Thank you, Lauren.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Our next show will feature the Baby Elmo Teen Parenting Program, which allows incarcerated teen parents to maintain contact with their children and provides them tools to build their parenting capacity and foster positive relationships in their children. So to stay informed about upcoming shows, you can either follow us here on Blog Talk Radio or visit the Children's Law Center's website at www.childrenslawky.org. Take care, and thank you again. Goodbye.